I'll record it.
Okay, sounds good.
So it's record. We're recording.
Awesome. Thank you. So good morning, everyone. For those of you that are new, welcome to the Social Impact Special Interest Group. We hold bi-weekly meetings, and welcome for joining today. So everyone's aware, we start each of our meetings with the Hyperledger Code of Conduct, as well as our antitrust policy notice. So you'll see that it's located right here. Please take a look at this. And if you guys ever have any questions about this, feel free to click on the link also available on our meeting agenda and notes. Just make sure that you're aware of what we consider as antitrust. And we'll get started in a minute. All right, so welcome again. So just to quickly get the meeting started, and I see quite a few new names on the call, let's do a quick round of introductions. So I can start off. My name is Nancy Min. I am the chair of the Social Impact Special Interest Group. I've been working with this community for about 10 months now, I think. Time flies. And mostly kind of my role in this is just to kind of help navigate, help onboard new members, get the group working on some new projects and interesting initiatives that the community feels is important, and just really try to foster that community feeling. So if you guys have any questions or interest in learning more about this, and also interest in learning about ways that you guys can help and contribute to our community, feel free to reach out at any time. I'm happy to help with that in any way possible. Karen, do you want to go next, since you are second on the list?
Did you say me? I didn't understand.
I did. Could you hear me?
Hi, I'm Karen. I'm with Hyperledger staff. I'm the point of contact on the staff for the Social Impact SIG. I am director of ecosystem at Hyperledger, and what that means is I work with our open source community in helping promote blockchain and what Hyperledger is doing, and specifically on the SIGs that I'm a point of contact for, work on building those communities. And then on the membership side of Hyperledger, I work with our members to learn and share about what they're building with our technologies as well.
Thanks, Karen. Hi, Alicia.
Sure. Hi, everybody. My name is Alicia Noel, and I do research and consulting related to food and ag supply chain innovation, specifically mostly looking at traceability and blockchain uses. Right now, I'm also helping edit a collection of research on how blockchain is being used for social and economic equity in ag and food supply chains for an academic journal out of Switzerland. So if you are interested in that but don't have info, please let me know and I'm happy to share more.
Hi, Sean.
Hello, hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, perfect. Hello, everybody. Sean Wilborn. I'm a graduate of University of Miami School of Law, currently studying for the bar. I'm in the Florida area. My focus is on waste and recycling, as well as clean water. We have a pilot project that I'm excited about that we're going to be launching in the fall. So hopefully by December, I'll have some bigger updates.
Which Paul?
Go ahead, Paul.
Sorry. So I'm Paul Sedrinot. I'm the program manager at DLab, which is an accelerator by SOSV that focuses on distributed ledgers and blockchain technology. And Sempo, which Nick Williams is a co-founder of, was one of our investments.
Welcome. Go ahead, Sean. Nancy, you're breaking up, so I'll do this. Sean, would you mind introducing yourself?
Well, yeah. Do you want me to say the same thing?
Oh, sorry.
Unless I'm signed in.
Sorry, I just was going down the list. Alfonso.
No worries.
Hi. Good morning. Alfonso Gobela from Mérida, Yucatán, Mexico. I'm co-founder of the Hyperledger Mérida meetup and community group, and also member of the new Hyperledger Latin American chapter. Glad to be here with you.
Great to see you, Alfonso. Kamlesh, did you already go?
Yeah. So I'm Kamlesh. I'm from India, and I lead the Hyperledger India chapter here. And I'm VP Blockchain for Eastern Future Tech. We are a blockchain product and consulting company. Our solution is supply chain, education, domain. Yeah.
Thank you. Javier?
Hello, everyone. I'm Javier from Hyperledger Argentina and the Latin American chapter.
Thanks for joining. Mark?
Yeah, hi. I'm Mark Liberati, working for as policy pillar head for United Nations Volunteers in Bonn, Germany. I was a volunteer myself and a lawyer, interested very much in smart contract, blockchain, working on a digital transformation project here on blockchain applications. And also, I think, as I mentioned before, participating in the Atrium, which is sort of an interagency UN platform for blockchain technology. Thank you.
Great to see you again, Mark. Nick, did we hear from you?
No, you have not. Shall I intro myself now, or intro myself during the presentation? Now, I guess. Now I'm speaking. So I'm Nick, and I'm the co-founder of Sempo. We're an organization that gets cash to vulnerable people, and I'll be talking more about that in 10 minutes. Yeah, N is the number of minutes when I'll be talking.
Thank you, Nick. Paul.
Yep. Yeah, other Paul on the call here. Paul Monahan. So I'm an associate at SOSV, working alongside Paul Sedrinot and Sean Broderick. So focused on the distributed ledger space, accelerating companies through the DLab program and on to becoming unicorns. So.
And Vinod?
Hello.
Hi, Vinod.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah. Hi. Hello, everyone. I'm Vinod Ahuja. Sorry for being late. I just joined. I'm a graduate assistant and a researcher on blockchain, especially focusing on the implications of blockchain in the organization setup. So that is my research area, and I'm especially interested in like how blockchain is creating an impactful society and organization culture. That's all from my side.
All right, thank you. Nancy, I think that's everybody. Did I miss anyone? Oh, Brian just joined us. Brian, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, good morning. I think I know most of you, but I'm Brian Bellendorf, Executive Director of Hyperledger.
Hey, Brian.
Welcome.
Hi, Brian.
All right, so can everyone still hear me, or am I still breaking up?
That's much better.
Much better? Okay. I'm trying my best. I resorted to the phone. Hopefully that's better. So just wanted to recap. So we have two main things of discussion for today's meeting. One of them is in continuation of our last call, where we had a special topic regarding racial injustice and exploring how blockchain technology can make an impact on that. And we can quickly go over some of those things that we discussed in the last call, and would love to kind of get the greater community's input and suggestions on how we can better make an impact in those areas. The other part is we're gonna hear from Senpo and learn about their project with respect to financial inclusion. And so I think Nick had just introduced himself a little bit, but we'll have him speak with us a little bit more in depth. So just to quickly kind of go through a few things that we talked about in the previous call, and we'll also review this on the next call as well. A few things that we wanted to get a good gauge from the community were, what are certain areas that the community was interested in exploring? Some of the ones that we've been working on over the past few months have been developing a new member center, social impact, SIG resource center, state of social impact blog post, as well as a discussion with Tamara from AWS about Animal ID project. And a couple of the ones that were brought up in the previous call, Brian had suggested that we work on engaging with various work groups, communities. Mike McCoy, who's from Consensus, also spoke about engaging with the Washington for Social Impact Coalition. And we also have had Menyu from Hyperledger, who also mentioned that we should expand, we could look at expanded Linux Foundation mentorship programs as a way where we could, as a SIG, develop project proposals to get developers to work with us on projects and look to find ways that we can bring a more direct impact to the community. And so that could be done through the community bridge with the team. So those are just a few things, just to kind of quickly recap. And if you guys have anything that comes up or you're thinking about, I can pause for a minute. But if not, we can continue this discussion on the next call, since we do have quite a few speakers for this call. Anything that comes up? Any comments? All right, great. I think everyone's excited to be talking about some interesting topics. So we'll move on for this one. So on the last call, we talked a little bit about racial injustice. And as I mentioned before, and exploring avenues in which blockchain technology can make an impact. A few things that came out of that discussion, and this is not a comprehensive list. One of them was that, you know, racial injustice is a global issue, and it's not merely just limited in its scope to just the U.S. or anything like that. And one of the other things, I think, Brian, if you want to speak a little bit about this as well, was the discussion on a police misconduct database and whether that could be something that, you know, blockchain technology could instill more trust in that process, especially as folks are looking at the grander scale of things and looking at ways that we can better trace you know, various misconducts throughout the chain. So Brian, would you be willing to kind of speak with us a little bit about what you had talked about last call?
Yeah, I just repeat a bit of it. You know, I've been trying to find an application of this technology to the issues of the day. And the thing that I keep seeing and reading about is the way that it seems like police officers who violate people's rights, who are habitual bad actors, seem to escape accountability as they move, especially as they move from one precinct to another, and often have their records either purged or just disappeared. And that seems like the kind of thing that a distributed ledger should be able to help us with. And so there are a couple of third-party external police accountability kinds of efforts out there. I don't have the list handy, so I can't, you know, but if you go out and look at it, you can find it. But they aren't incredibly well funded. They do seem to come at it from a very much an activist point of view rather than as a reference point. You know, you'd ideally want something that could serve as the system of record, right, for police misconduct and be recognized as objective in the same way that Wikipedia is. So this is still just a thought experiment. I haven't seen anybody actively interested in this or moving in this direction yet. And so I haven't, nor have I had the energy or time to push it forward directly, but whether it's this or whether it's another application of DLT, I'm optimistic there's something here. And if anyone's interested in pushing this forward, I can connect you to the research I've done. But it's really just early conversations. I don't want to push this as something that's going to happen or anything. Going down the road of, well, how could we apply this technology to solving what seems like an information coordination and system of record problem. And hopefully it's not the only place that we could apply this tech.
Absolutely, Brian. And I think, you know, the purpose of this is just to get the conversation started. And especially since, you know, with the community that's all engaged on the social impact causes, you know, it could be something that we could look into and potentially do some a little bit more research on. Especially with, I think you mentioned some existing solutions, you know, where DLT could really provide something that just screams more value and can, and I personally think it's potentially in the really the instilling trust, because I think with any type of third party of records or anything like that, we want to make sure that we can trust, you know, that validation or endorsement process that information is correct. That could be something that I think the blockchain would really pretty good value, but definitely would open that to the community for any kind of comments or inputs from that.
Yes, I mean, this is Mark. I just wanted to just jump in. I mean, just around thinking around like reimagining public safety and sort of like SDG 16 on justice, which does come before peace in SDG 16, and then on goal 10 and reducing inequalities and then sustainable cities. You know, I think there's a lot of thought around, I mean, what blockchain can do for like reporting human rights violations and timestamp, like keeping a immutable record, and then those pictures can then be sent up, and you could then merge that with our, you know, potential artificial intelligence, like you have reporting mechanisms even in Twitter, right, where the AI is then sort of aggregating those pictures, and if then it seems statistically valid, then that would then get escalated up to a human rights body that could then potentially look at that. I think also in looking around consensus protocols for community policing and oversight boards on how that then is decided, and you can reimagine all different ways of how public safety figures of a neighborhood are chosen, maybe by the neighborhood or oversaw by the neighborhood, and also then how that can be monitored in a system of, you know, digital safety, and how that then is balanced against data privacy, and then also given community input through consensus protocols. So just to sort of, there again, these were just ideations, but I just thought just to start a conversation, I would share those thoughts. Thank you. Over.
And Brian, I just got the links that you just sent, and I'll post those right here so that folks have this and it can be something we can look at.
Those are just two links that go a little bit further in what I was talking about. One is an example of a centralized approach to third-party police accountability that I uncovered. The other is one of many articles on this, but one I think did a good job of capturing both the problem and the potential.
Sounds good. So I think with what Mark said, you know, it definitely does seem like something that's very well aligned, you know, with a lot of the causes that we're seeing, especially, you know, a lot of the press right now. Brian, you know, what do you think in terms of like where you want to kind of see this go? Because I think with respect to the links that you just sent, you know, I think this could be something that we could sit a little bit on and kind of do some more research on to get a good understanding of what could potentially be you know, nail down the use case a little bit more or refine that a little bit more. Yeah. Do you think that's a good approach?
I don't want to over-index over one example, but maybe mm-hmm. this is the right example. If this particular use case is interesting to folks, maybe just starting an informal conversation off to the side about you know, what it would take to look at this, and maybe even do. I mean, I hate being technology led, so like doing a proof of concept first feels awkward. Mm-hmm. I've really just tried to be listening a lot and engaging with lawyers, engaging with people in this space. If anyone has a particular connection to this space, a particular resonance with that use case, perhaps knows of organizations working in this space, I'd be happy to start a conversation and see if, you know, before any of us write any code, whether there's something appropriate here. My one criteria would be, I really want this to be something that would have that same kind of referential objectivity that like the Wikipedia has, rather than be seen as strictly an activist database, right? Which I think has value, but if we really want this to be like the independent system of record, it's something where, you know, you'd want mayors to not be able to ignore this when their police departments hire a bad cop, right? And not have that plausible deniability. Anyways, if anyone's interested in this, get in touch with me. My email's not hard to find. I'll type it in chat. I want to kind of offline it for a little bit before wasting too many people's time on it here on this call or otherwise. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That sounds great. And I will raise my hand as the first one. I'll definitely reach out to you. But if there are any other folks on the call who are interested in this, feel free to just kind of holler and I can add everyone's name and we can, you know, find a way to sync up and continue the discussion on this. All right. Sounds good. So I'll leave that as kind of an open-ended thing. So if, you know, folks are interested, you guys all, I think most for the most part have the LFID and you can just put your name right here. So looking for folks interested in this effort, please make sure, and I'll put my name right here. Please make sure to just put your name on the side and we can reach out to you and figure out what the next steps would be and kind of clarify that the use case for this. Any other comments from the community before we talk about, move on to what Sempo's presentation is? Any other comments or anything? Any feedback? All right, sounds good. So, you know, I really appreciate Brian, to coming and talking to us about the use case. There's a lot of potential here, and we just need to figure out where the right angle to this is going to be, I guess. So, just moving on a little bit into this. One of the things I did want to highlight, one of the, I think Alicia, you actually mentioned this, is that the Frontiers in Blockchain Research collection on blockchain uses for social and economic equality in agriculture and food production has an open call that is due for September 30th. So if you guys are interested in this, there's also the link, and Alicia, who's on the call, feel free to reach out to Alicia, and I'm sure she can point folks in the right direction and make sure that we can publish some interesting works in this sector.
One thing to note is Frontiers is an open source journal, so there is a fee to publish. For people whose organizations do not sponsor them, there are waivers available. You just need to send in a request and fill out a form. So please don't let the fee be a barrier.
Sounds good. That's exciting. Awesome. So without further ado, I just wanted to save some time. So so Alicia actually introduced me to Nick and Tristan from Sempo. And today they'll be talking about some of their financial inclusion work. And I won't go too much into detail without spoiling anything. But I did get a preview of the slides this morning. So thanks, Nick, for sending that over. So Nick, do you want me to give you the sharing of this so that you could present? Yeah, or do you want me to go through the slides? All right, sounds good.
That'd be great. Oh, no, I've got a screen loaded, so I'll just share.
Okay, I'm going to pause. stop my share. Let's see if you can, you can join.
Share desktop two. And okay, how is my big opening slide appearing for everyone?
Looks great.
Great. All right. Cool. So Alicia, thanks for asking me to speak here. It's really exciting. You know, often when I talk with groups, they're often either from the social impact space without a lot of understanding about blockchain, or from the blockchain space without a lot of understanding about social impact. So to be able to, you know, speak to a group that has a solid understanding of both fields is really, really exciting. So it means I can use some slightly different material to what I normally go down. So as briefly mentioned, my name's Nick and I'm one of the co-founders of Sempo. Sempo has been around for about 3 years now. And we work on the problem of how to get cash to vulnerable people. Now, when I mean vulnerable people, generally I mean people who have been affected by rapid onset disasters. So things like volcanoes and earthquakes and sort of the traditional disasters. But I also mean people who suffer from long-term poverty, whether that's overseas in emerging markets or even locally in developed markets like Australia and the US, that, you know, just would really benefit from just getting cash. So with that, I may as well dive straight in. So why cash aid when I talk about this concept? Cash aid is a relatively new concept in the spectrum of the way we think about helping people. And it's basically just this idea that instead of giving people stuff, so things like rice, bags of rice or clothing or shelter, you know, the things you typically imagine being shipped in by a big emergency response program, we just give them money and let them make their own choices. And the reason this is so powerful is that fundamentally, we tend to be pretty terrible at working out what people actually need during a disaster response or any sort of vulnerability. And so I love this stat, this idea that 70% of Syrian refugees have sold what they've been given to buy what they actually need just speaks to how terrible we are at this process. And so cash not only shortcuts this entire process, it's just fundamentally very, very empowering to tell people, you know, you're in charge, you know best how you need to help yourselves. Here's some money, go buy what you want. It's not appropriate in all circumstances. If there's no economy left or, you know, entire marketplace has been wiped out, then cash isn't going to help much and you just need to drop it in food. But in many cases, it's really powerful and actually helps stimulate the local economy. So it's a really interesting idea that's over the last 20 years has become more and more popular. The challenge with cash is that it's not done very often. And this is the sort of what Sempo became really interested in, is sort of why cash was such a small part of total humanitarian spending. And there's some core reasons to this. And one of the fundamental reasons is that, frankly, it's just very hard to get cash into vulnerable communities. The communities that we tend to think of when we think of, you know, disaster responses are classically the ones where financial infrastructure just tends not to exist. They're not the sort of place where you can just mail $1,000 or send $1,000 to someone's bank account and then tell them to go down to the bank down the street. This infrastructure often just simply doesn't exist, or it may be hours away. And even if it does exist, say even if it is a developed market like the US or Australia, people often just lack the documentation required to open a bank account. There is, unfortunately and perhaps unsurprisingly, a huge correlation between vulnerability and a lack of financial inclusion. So even sometimes we just can't even use those processes anyway. And finally, often if you're taking money from an overseas donor like the USAID, so a US government donor, and trying to shift it into an emerging market, you'll lose a ton of that money through currency conversion. And so these all collectively add up to one of the reasons that so many NGOs, so charities like the Red Crosses and the Oxfams of the world, really don't do as much cash as they perhaps like to. And so this is something we really set up to change and address. And one of the first things we actually started to do was try to just experiment. This was in early 2018. Experiment with how to get cash to people affected by crises, just ourselves. And this is a picture of Mount Mayon in the Philippines. And in early 2018, it actually erupted. And that village at the base there was very understandably forced to evacuate because there was just this huge risk of the villages basically being engulfed. And we had this really bizarre experience where we were able to speak to people in real time over Facebook Messenger. They were able to send us videos of this volcano erupting as they were evacuating. And we literally had no idea how to send the money. And I just thought this was such a strange disconnect that technology around communication had advanced to such a point that we could have these real time conversations. Yet if I wanted to send them money within the next 4 days, it was just not plausible. And we had this really interesting discussion with someone who was evacuating. They said, you know, you're not going to find a way to get me money, but I know exactly what I need to go and buy from the local store. So why don't you just let me buy what I want and then you can repay back the store? And we thought this was a pretty interesting idea because stores tend to have a higher level of financial inclusion than most individuals, and it meant that we could basically just repay a store, give, you know, credits to people, and then they could spend them at the store, and then we could just repay that store in bulk, and it would massively simplify this whole cash distribution process. And so we actually built this really basic SMS based credit tracking process that used, you know, just this SMS process to send people credits, and then we track that on a Postgres database. And then we'd tally their spends at various stores using this little hotline, and then we would then repay these stores. This then evolved into a blockchain-based process where we actually started to track these credit spends using the blockchain and created quite a sophisticated dashboard and tracking system for NGOs to actually use this themselves. We're blockchain agnostic, and I'll talk a little bit more about sort of being fit for purpose later, though we do tend to use Ethereum at this stage. It tends to be the most fit for purpose in the circumstances we've found. We also built an Android app that goes alongside it and a contactless payment card for people who don't have access to mobile phones, and we've used that in a few circumstances. Since that time 2 years ago, we've helped empower through this process around 120,000 people, and we're currently averaging about 1 million payments a year through the platform of these social aid payments. Organizations that we've worked with to actually distribute aid include Mercy Corps, Oxfam, and the Red Cross, and Coinbase, actually, through their social impact arm, Give Crypto. Oxfam last year ran the first ever government-funded or government-donor-funded cryptocurrency-based aid project through the platform in Vanuatu. And through using the platform, they were able to speed up their aid delivery time by 96% over their regular cash transfer program, which was, you know, really pleasing. So that's where we're at currently. So I guess one of these things that I've been really, you know, working through in my head, and it's for the last 2 years, is why certain things need blockchain. For example, why do we need blockchain in what we're doing? Technically, still a lot of it runs, you know, on a Postgres database. And a lot of that would still be valid, even if you were to take off the blockchain. You can still track credits. After all, this is what Venmo does, this is what PayPal does, it's what M-Pesa does. They've been running effectively these vouchers on a database, you know, for decades very successfully. And, you know, thinking through this has really, you know, really given me pause to like really take a step back and think about like, you know, what blockchain does fundamentally. And, you know, flippantly speaking, you know, blockchain is in many ways a regular computer. You have some sort of set of rules around data manipulation, and then you have data storage. So blockchain is a regular computer that's really, really hard to work with, because we use some sort of consensus mechanism to encode these rules and some sort of, you know, distributed ledger to basically set these in place. And that costs a lot of money to basically develop these processes compared to, you know, coding something up on Python. And they're very, you know, strict and hard to iterate through and all those things that if you're a dev on the blockchain, you're very used to. Fortunately, you know, developing the client side is not so hard. And so, I mean, we see a lot of, you know, talk of things that, you know, would be, you know, great on the blockchain, hypothetically, you know, involve more sharing of data. And, you know, we hear about this idea of this trustlessness that you can bring in, the transparency you can bring. But I think it's worth keeping in mind that fundamentally there is already a status quo in terms of like how we can achieve many of these things. If you need to do just trustless donations and you want to do donation tracking, as Senpo does, a lot of this could be done by just asking one of the big four accountants to store some core part of your API that includes some sort of ledger rule on their own servers in an audited manner. And you would hit a lot of that transparency. And it would be a lot more agile because you could update your code through code reviews rather than being enforced into contracts. And it would be probably cheaper because you can use a plain old programming language. The downside is that you would have to spend some cost to develop some sort of, and you'd have to pay those accountants to develop that interface between, say, in my example here, you know, perhaps this is a digital identity service for medical records, for instance. So when I think of blockchain projects, I always come back to, you know, how does the blockchain add something that we can't possibly achieve through just using a regular database held in a big four accountant's office? And I think one of the classic ones that I keep on coming back to is that this works great. This model works great if you've just got one use case. You've got just medical digital identity stored directly onto the database. Scales really nicely. But once you start needing to use these hypothetical identities or something for more than one use case, then you start to need to organize more and more relationships with your accountant. And each firm needs to go and sort this out on themselves. And maybe each firm needs to make changes to this code base. And then there becomes questions about who owns the core framework behind this. And it all falls apart very badly. And so I think the blockchain becomes really, really powerful for me in this very specific use case, in that blockchain makes it possible to integrate a common backbone or a common framework over these disparate use cases. And so to me, this comes back to this trustlessness that, you know, we often talk about, but there's a subtle distinction here, which is that it's not just about trustlessness in a regular state between, you know, one common use case, one killer app. It's really about this idea of trustlessness over integration over this common framework. And I think this is really why we started to see the DeFi space start to grow very rapidly, is because we do have this, you know, this common backbone that everyone is iterating on. And I think, you know, digital identity is another great example of that. And there are many more. For Senpo, though, it really is that financial aspect that I think really makes us really able to leverage the capacity of the blockchain. And because we can integrate into a huge range of these cryptocurrency services, particularly off-ramps in regions, blockchain allows us to move funds into regions and get funds into vulnerable people in regions that we just can't access through the regular financial networks. So a classic example of this is, say, we're currently working in Venezuela. We can't access the banking system in Venezuela. It is just totally excluded from us. So we have no regular pathways for getting money into Venezuela. What we can do is we can use a popular cryptocurrency over there and just integrate with off-ramp providers over there and rely on them to actually provide that exchange of value to those vendors. And so this has that element of trustlessness, but it also has that element of integration. And this is something that PayPal and Venmo cannot do because their voucher just doesn't become valid somewhere else. So this to me is like one of those cases of why blockchain potentially does have some specific uses. So Moving on to, I just want to share two lessons that I think we've really learnt over the last 2 years while working on this project. The very first project that we actually tried to launch the platform for in earnest was we were actually working in the northern Lebanese region of Akkar with Syrian refugees over there. We were right on the border of Syria. And we were interested in running a cash transfer program there, and we wanted to use a payment card. We just thought it would be a very easy way to scale this out quickly to a lot of people. So we developed a very basic tap to pay process with a card that basically had an ID on it that would allow us to make transfers. The first thing we did when we arrived in Akkar, however, was we actually just went and spoke to a lot of refugees about their experience with making payments. And one thing we discovered to our surprise was that there was already an existing cash transfer program being run in that refugee camp, or had been run previously by a UN agency. And in many ways, this program was similar to ours. It used a debit MasterCard, or a very restricted debit MasterCard, or Visa or something, instead of blockchain. But they were giving cards to refugees who were then told they could go and pay it, spend it at certain stores. Somewhere along the lines, some communication had become very mixed up, and all of these refugees were writing their pins on the back of their cards like this. This is my card, that's not my pin. For obvious reasons. But this is really what it looked like. And then what would happen is that these refugees would go to a store, they would hand their card across to a vendor who would then check the pin on their card, insert their card into the payment device, and then insert the amount they're going to pay, and then type in the pin for the refugee. There's, to you and I, there's very obvious security implications about this. But from the point of the refugees, the security of the card being stolen wasn't actually anywhere near their main concern. The thing we heard over and over again was that what they hated about this process was that it handed the entire control of the payment process over to the vendor. The vendor was free to type in any amount they wanted to charge and then enter the PIN, and there was no chance for the refugee to actually see how much was being entered into the payment device. Because they never had that device in their hands. And many refugees felt that they were being overcharged because of this. And so we heard over and over again that what they wanted was the opportunity to see how much they were being charged before actually having that payment go through. The other thing we learned was that almost every single refugee family we spoke to actually had an Android phone. At least one person in the family had an Android phone. And so what we did is we actually developed a very basic Android app. We locked ourselves into a room in Beirut for a couple of days and developed this very basic Android app where the vendor would generate a QR code and then the refugee would scan it and it would come up in these big letters. Do you want to, you know, you are paying 12,000 Lebanese pounds. Do you want to make that payment? Yes or no? And they could tick or cross. And we tested it and the refugee families absolutely loved it. Even people with, you know, significant literacy issues or learning disabilities were able to operate with this system. And so that ended up to be very successful. And so, I mean, the big lesson I think there is that localization is really important when we think about how to use blockchain. I think, you know, when we think about blockchain, we often think about these common frameworks and, you know, it's very tempting for us to try and homogenize the way we interact with the blockchain. And I think we've seen this already. You know, Bitcoin wallets all fundamentally have a very similar payment interface. You know, Lightning Network implies a lot about how you make payments, as does the Ethereum payment network and so on. And I think this is a really risky assumption that we can homogenize the way people interact with money around the world, because the reality is that payments are fundamentally very diverse. And so to me, it's important that everyone should keep in mind that blockchain should be a tool that helps us integrate unique and locally contextualized ways that we all interact with different systems, rather than force them to be all the same thing. Because if you do that, you're going to miss out on a lot of cultural nuances around how people behave that just aren't captured. And so we've actually used many different payment mechanisms depending on the local context. So on the right is a photo of a feature phone using Senpo to make a payment in Kenya. with a program we're doing over there. And so this is because in Kenya, people are very used to making payments on feature phones. So we adapted to that model. And on the left is a program we were running with Oxfam in Vanuatu. And this did use the cards with some adaptations. And one of the crucial adaptations was that the card was actually modified to store some of the state on the card itself on a in a cryptographic manner. And that allowed us to actually do certain amount of caching of transactions offline when the internet went down and then resync that up because we found that the internet was very unreliable in Vanuatu, especially after a crisis. And I think these adaptations, when you think about the way we apply blockchain in development and impact situations, are really, really important to keep in mind. So I'm going to jump across to a financial or a regulatory lesson now. So this is the method we'd really like to use when we sort of think about this. And I'm using DAI as an example here, so the DAI stablecoin on Ethereum. But it really does apply to any sort of process. We'd like to basically have a complete flow of cryptocurrency from the donor to an NGO, distribute that to affected people, who then make a payment with a vendor, and then Sempo or some other local exchange then cashes out that payment and we take the crypto and pay them by a bank. This seems very clean and lovely and it makes a great little picture, but the unfortunate reality is that in most places that we operate, it's actually pretty much illegal, or in a lot of places it is. And this is because it basically involves giving funds money, because in many ways, you know, a stablecoin is money, to people who you know very minimal information about. And unfortunately, the reality is that know your customer and anti-money laundering and counter-terrorism financing laws are really important and they do exist for a reason. And so this just, for many reasons, just isn't acceptable. What we actually played around with trying to understand like the problems of, you know, distributing money to people with minimal identity, and is an idea around actually distributing vouchers to people and escrowing the funds. So we built one of the ways we've worked around this is to build an escrow based contract where the funds are locked up, and for each dollar put in, we mint an equivalent voucher. And these vouchers have less liquidity or less fungibility, I guess, than the underlying cryptocurrency, which means that an affected person, we can be comfortable an affected person isn't going to sell this on a third party exchange and then use that to buy, you know, a machine gun or something in a terrorist situation. And then we have a whitelist of approved parties who are able to then unwrap the funds to access the underlying cryptocurrency. So this basically allows us to design a sort of a two-tiered system that creates different levels of liquidity for the currency, depending on how much you know about that person, how much identity you have on that person. In many ways, you know, this sort of these wall creating these gates is, you know, antithetical to the way we'd like to think about perhaps the ideal world in which we operate in blockchain and, you know, a largely permissionless space. But the reality is that this allows us to get some form of cash aid to people who would otherwise be completely off limits when we think about regulatory expectations. And so in many ways, it's really powerful to create this sort of this single integrated system that has multiple levels of KYC compliance all built into one. And so I think the lesson we've learned here is that if you ignore regulation, it can just turn into a massive pain and you can find yourself really fighting it and getting pushed back because that regulation is in there for a good reason. However, if you pay attention to the regulation and really understand what the intent of it is, you can actually begin to leverage it to your advantage and begin to leverage blockchain to the advantage of meeting those regulatory expectations rather than having it fight. And this is, I think, a really powerful thing to think about because it sort of sits a little bit, you know, orthogonal to the narrative that we normally have around blockchain as, you know, quite this regulatorily dangerous thing that allows, you know, terrorists to rule the world. I think we can actually really find some good common ground there that actually allows us to actually push financial inclusion in the direction we want to. So that's all from me. There's my email address if you would like to, you know, reach out or speak about financial inclusion or anything to do with the blockchain and impact space. I'm always keen for a chat. Our code base is open source. So you can find it at GitHub, at Team Sempo. So yeah, with the time left, I'd love to answer any questions.
Yeah. Hi, listen, Mark, I was just quickly wanted to ask about the voucher system. A, mm-hmm. if it was a utility token, and on the regulation, also if it was a fungible token or voucher, because you can imagine then you'd want to allocate it to the person for that defined purpose to get food or whatever, but not to then exchange. I mean, just to keep it within the regulation that you mentioned. That's my question.
Mm-hmm. So it was fully fungible. I don't know if I would define it as a utility token. I think it does sit in a weird regulatory space. I'd probably just define it as a regular voucher, rather than sort of when we think about sort of the DeFi space of, you know, those utility tokens we're beginning to see float around. In terms of those intended purposes, the way we basically locked down the intended purpose, so to speak, is that we knew the vendors who were accepting it. And we included a whitelist in terms of like who was actually able to sort of accept it as a token and off-ramp it into actual cash. So because even though, you know, you could, you know, spend it quite freely within this space, we were comfortable that, you know, people were only spending it, you know, at the dozen vendors we had on the community. And, you know, none of those vendors, we weren't onboarding any of those vendors who were, you know, questionably selling, you know, weapons or anything like that. So it basically, by creating a somewhat closed loop, we were able to push the KYC process up a tier. It did mean that we had to do pretty rigorous KYC on the vendors to understand the expectations of like how they would be, you know, spending the money and what they were selling, but that was an easier task to, you know, it's a 10 times easier task to, you know, go through that process on vendors than it is on individual recipients. I saw this questions in the chat, but I'm not smart enough to work out how to open the chat. Ah, this. Okay, so I've got, does anyone else have any questions? Wasn't actually any questions in the chat.
Hi, Nick. This is Alicia quickly. Thank you so much for this. It's great to hear an update because I haven't spoken to you about what you guys are up to in over a year now. I'm curious how the gas charges for Ethereum, et cetera, are impacting funds available for disbursement and what you're seeing around budgeting for that and planning for that, etc.
Yeah, this is a hugely scary thing for us right now, to be frank. The last 2 months has just been insane. So 8 months ago, what we do is that given that we would just put in very low bids, and given that there's a lot of the system does a lot of caching already in terms of offline mode, we would just let the transactions take, you know, several hours to go through. And we were just, given what we were working with small values, we would just sort of optimistically settle them locally for the vendors. We have explored, and we actually are using different side chains currently. So the XDAI side chain is currently a lot cheaper right now. Mm-hmm. And we've also explored some, you know, layer two solutions like Optimistic Rollup. For the time being, I think we'll find ourselves on the side chains. I really don't like being on the side chains. I think that it's quite contrary to the sort of the philosophy of how sort of open finance is supposed to be working. And once again, to that original point, if you're using a side chain, then you're massively reducing your capacity to integrate into third-party services and off-ramps, even if they do have connections to main chains. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of banking on, while that's a subpar short-term solution, that the, you know, these layer two scaling solutions like Optimistic Rollup and, you know, ZK Snarks do help us as well as, you know, ETH 2. I'm praying, to be frank.
Got it. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your presentation. It was really, really interesting and really appreciate you taking the time to share with us and hope to continue to see you here participating in the SIG with us as well and continuing the conversation. we are at the end of the meeting. So if you have any other questions, please send it to Nick at his email, nick@withsimple.com. Nancy lost her audio, so I'll just wrap up the meeting here and we'll see you in 2 weeks, and she'll send around the notes and recording. Thank you, everyone.